Now, comrades, the political debate between Marxism and anarchism is one which has never been characterized by a very high degree of theoretical and intellectual clarity. In the 100 years since Marx's death, the debate between those who accept the ideas of Marx and those who accept the ideas of the anarchist founders has been fierce. At times it has been quite vicious and thoughtless, but it is one in which the issues involved have been primarily assumed rather than stated. Now, there are several reasons for this haziness about the issues in the debate. Firstly, it has to be said that very few Marxists have ever actually read the voluminous works of the political founders of anarchism. To plough through Proudhon's general idea of the revolution and his system of economic contradictions, to read Bakunin's revolutionary catechism, his statism and anarchy, his letters to a Frenchman, to read Max Stirner's The Ego and His Own, to read Kropotkin's Mutual Aid. To go through all of these are very laborious tasks, and noticeably, the people who have very often been the most vociferous in opposing anarchism have been the people who have been the least well-read in any serious analysis of what it said. Now, Karl Marx himself was an exception to this. Of all the works that I mentioned, apart from Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, which was, of course, written after Marx's death, Marx was quite well aware. Marx entered into a brief correspondence with Proudhon. He was well aware from his participation in the First International of Bakunin, and he devoted a large part of his great work, The German Ideology, to the works of Max Stirner. But the whole of the first part is dealing with a refutation of the anarchist principles in Stirner's book, The Ego and His Own. He also devoted what I regard as one of the most badly written of his polemical works, The Poverty of Philosophy, to an attack upon the works and ideas of Proudhon. And certainly that was a very unsatisfactory and unpleasant kind of debate. Now, there are very few Marxists then who have undertaken any serious analysis of precisely what the positions of the anarchists were. For example, over the last 50 or so years, some of the most biting and bitter criticisms of anarchist writings have come from Russia. And, of course, in Russia, over the last 50 years, the works of Proudhon, of Bakunin, of Kropotkin, and of Stirner simply have not been available in the universities. Many of the people issuing the attacks simply have not known what they were criticizing. But if the so-called Marxists have suffered from a non-reading of anarchist literature, the anarchist opponents of Marxism share an intellectual hostility to the works of Marx, which is almost universally based upon an ignorance, an unawareness of what Marx actually said and what Marx actually did. The traditional anarchist image of Marx as a Hegelian lover of the state, for whom socialism and centralization were synonymous conceptions, is not only false, but it in fact runs counter to almost everything that Marx said, and I shall produce some evidence to show this. A second reason for the serious misconceptions in this debate between Marxists and anarchists is that there are many people who have called themselves Marxists who've taken it upon themselves to attack anarchism, and many people who have called themselves anarchists who have taken it upon themselves to defend anarchism, who are certainly not worthy of either of the titles. In the case of the self-styled Marxists, I'm referring, of course, to the advocates of Leninism, for whom socialism means capitalism with the state owning and controlling capital. And in the course of this talk, I intend to demonstrate the fundamental opposition between the Leninist and the Marxist conceptions of the state. For the moment, I shall simply say that the Leninist defense of state power and the anarchist critique of that defense constitute an important political debate, but it is not the debate between Marxism and anarchism. It is a debate between Leninism and anarchism, and these must be regarded as two quite different things. Similarly, when we talk about anarchism, I do not include in that everyone who calls themselves an anarchist. I don't, in other words, regard as an anarchist every person who decides to go through a period of momentary rebellion, every rock singer who decides to write on the back of his album sleeve that he has been an anarchist for 5 years and wants to smash the state, or every person who feels that by engaging in acts of unthinking terrorism, they are engaging in some sort of serious philosophical debate. When I talk about anarchism, I'm talking about the works written by the anarchists of the 19th century. I'm talking about the movement which has developed in the 20th century based upon those works. And there is a third area of confusion in the Marxist-anarchist debate, and it's not unique to the Marxist-anarchist debate. It goes on in almost every clash of ideas. And I am referring here to the tendency of political scientists, or people who are supposed to be experts in looking at ideas, they very rarely are, to see Marxism and anarchism purely in the realm of ideas. Now, to do this is profoundly mistaken, because political theories are not simply ideas. The combat between these ideas do not simply go on within a purely academic circle. They are not something which are simply the subject of academic scrutiny. The test of any idea of a political nature has to be its application to society, the extent to which it actually serves to say anything and describe anything and ultimately to change anything in the social setup. So it's necessary then to turn to these social problems which found proposed solutions in Marxism and anarchism. Now, in brief, I'll sum them up under four headings. Firstly, in the 19th century, there was the problem of capitalism as a new stage of oppression in the history of property relationships. Secondly, there was the problem of the state as a coercive and an oppressive force in society. Thirdly, there was the problem of changing society and the need for a mechanism of transformation which does not reflect the oppressive characteristics of non-revolutionary capitalist bodies. And fourthly, there is the problem of creating a free and harmonious society, or I should perhaps say a free and harmonious state of affairs, because there are certain anarchists, Stirner being the main one, who would deny that freedom or harmony are compatible with the existence of a society as such. Now, these were the problems which Marx and his anarchist opponents applied themselves to. In the mid-19th century, these were relatively new political problems for various reasons. Capitalism, in its industrial advanced form, was still in its historical infancy at the time when Marx and his anarchist rivals were facing each other. The feudal and mercantilist relationships of earlier centuries had given way to a new mode of wealth production and distribution. The social system, then as now, was marked by certain characteristics, and these characteristics in turn were marked by major contradictions. Now, the first characteristic of capitalism is the minority ownership of the means of producing and distributing wealth. In other words, the factories, the farms, the mines, the offices, the docks, the newspapers, these are not the possession of the entire community. They are the possession of a small capital-owning class. The second characteristic of capitalism is a logical consequence of the first one. If social wealth is monopolized by a minority, then the majority must be in a relatively, virtually propertyless position. And this is a position of the majority class in society, then as now, the working class. Those people who have nothing to sell in the marketplace but their mental and physical energy, ability to work. And as a majority class, the wage and salary earners, the people who produce wealth but do not possess it, were a relatively new social class in 19th century Europe. The existence of a mass urban working class, no property, nothing to do but go and sell its labour power for a price called a wage or salary, was something new in 19th century Europe. But what then was the relationship, and is still the relationship, of these two classes under capitalism? It is an inherently exploitative relationship, with one class exploiting the other. Because the purpose of production under capitalism is sale on the market with a view to profit, and that profit goes to the capitalist owners. And unless it is profitable, then goods are not sold and needs remain unmet. Now, how is it that the capitalists obtain these profits? They obtain them by paying workers wages, or salaries, it amounts to the same thing, which are always less than the value of the product of the workers' labour. And so the contradictions of the profit system were quite obvious to any critical observer in the 19th century, just as they are now. Just as in 1982, there is poverty alongside the potentiality for plenty, so there was then. There was luxury for parasitic owners of capital, and there was the most awful deprivation for the wealth producers, and so there is now. There was technological advance, but this was turned against the people who produced the wealth, and turned them in turn into appendages to machines. So capitalism was and is a system worthy of the most vigorous hostility from that majority class which it oppresses, which it exploits. Now, I am not going to engage into in an argument about whether Marxists or anarchists were more hostile, more vigorous in their condemnation of this system. There are all sorts of people in the world today who are very critical of capitalism. You don't have to be a socialist to be in that position. They have regarded capitalism with hostility. But the historical perspective from which Marxists and anarchists criticize the system is an important dividing point. Because whereas Marx's entire critique of capitalism placed it within the framework of a materialist conception of history, saw capitalism as a stage in the evolution of property society, saw it as a mode of wealth production, and the anarchist critics, on the other hand, I would argue, failed to perceive it as such. They did not see it as a system. They did not place it within its historical framework as part of an evolutionary chain of systematic transformation from one stage of society to another, from slavery to feudalism to capitalism, through stages of wealth production suiting different social needs in line with different technological developments throughout history. Now, this is not the time, because I simply haven't got the time to do it, to go into Marx's penetrating economic analysis of capitalism. But those of you who have read any of Marx's economic writings, and in particular Capital, will have been struck by two points. Firstly, you'll notice its constant reference to the theory of history. Marx cannot handle any economic concept. He cannot look at anything without recognizing its transitory historical nature. For Marx, nothing was absolute. To defend or to condemn any social arrangement because it conflicts with moral or human invariables was regarded by Marx as unhistorical idealism. He rejected it. And secondly, Marx was a political economist, and the emphasis I put upon political, because to him, every social event was political. Every social event involved a power relationship, a class relationship. And Marx never looked at an event as somehow having an existence of its own. Every event was perceived either by the exploiters, the exploited, the oppressors, the oppressed. Now, this was in marked contrast with the anarchist attitude towards the system which they were condemning. For example, Proudhon wrote, and I quote, "Justice is the central star which governs society, the pole around which the political world revolves, the principal regulator of all transactions. Now, Proudhon leaves his readers in no doubt whatsoever. Modern society, as far as he is concerned, is unjust, and therefore it must be changed. Now, to remedy social injustice, to abolish the violations of the natural law, to inaugurate a state of affairs which was just, was the classical 19th century anarchist objective. Now, Marx rejected this objective. He, on the other hand, rejected entirely the absolute yardstick of justice as a method of social criticism. He said that it was futile, it was unhistorical to look at something in society and say, that's unjust, that's unfair, that's unreasonable in itself. As Marx explains, he writes this in Volume 3 of Capital, about his conception of justice, and I quote, "The justice of transactions which go on between agents of production rests on the fact that these transactions arise as natural consequences from the relations of production. The juristic forms in which these economic transactions appear as voluntary actions of the participants cannot, being mere forms, determine this content. They merely express it. This content is just whenever it corresponds to the mode of production. It is unjust whenever it contradicts that mode. Slavery on the basis of the capitalist mode of production is unjust. So is fraud in the quality of commodities." And because Marx realized that the concept of justice was just as historically transitory as the systems and the institutions which were being examined and measured against the yardstick of justice, therefore it would be historically naive and futile to condemn capitalism simply for being unjust. Now, let me assure you, this is no mere semantic quibble, I dare say, and the arguments about what Marx would or wouldn't have said, people have enough arguments about what he did say without what he might have said, but I dare say, nevertheless, that in common parlance, to say capitalism is an unjust, exploitative, oppressive society, this I think Marx may not have disagreed with. It's a very reasonable point of view in common parlance. But as soon as we deal, as Marx insisted in dealing, and many of his anarchist opponents did, in definite philosophical terms, then the idea of an unjust society has to be rejected. Indeed, it is at the very centre of the division between Marxism and anarchists over the nature of social criticism and the method of social criticism. Because Marx's opposition to capitalism did not claim the validity of eternal justice. For Marx, capitalism was quite just on its own terms, from the point of view of the capitalist accumulating capital, taking surplus value, exploiting workers. This was justice. But as an economic system, Marx's criticism of capitalism was that it could not work in the interests of the majority. And it was on the basis of the class interest of the majority that Marx opposed the profit system. Now, the 19th century anarchists either lacked any conception of class, and this, I would argue, was certainly the case with Max Stirner and, to a great extent, with Bakunin, or they were anxious to recreate old, romanticized, semi-feudal class relationships. And this was a position that Proudhon was in a very great phrase in the Communist Manifesto. Marx said about Proudhon, he wants to create a capitalist system where the proletariat doesn't exist and the capitalist class does. He wants to defend the people who are doing well and wipe away the bits of capitalism, the majority class, where exploitation takes place. It was, according to Marx, a naive and utopian view of capitalism because they lacked a conception of class. Now, it would not be difficult to argue that the philosophical difference between Marx and his anarchist opponents was one between materialism and idealism. Marx saw capitalism as the root of social problems. It wasn't the root of every problem, of course. It wasn't nobody in their right mind would argue that capitalism is the cause of earthquakes or the occasional famines, but it is a cause of social problems which affect people in their day-to-day lives as a result of the social setup. The anarchists observed the problems and saw the system as a manifestation of these injustices. Now, in no way is this demonstrated more clearly than in the divergent views between Marx and his anarchist rivals over the state. The anarchists were united and still are united by a perfectly healthy hostility to the state machine. Government, laws, prisons, armies, judges, every single aspect of the coercive state was considered to them to be oppressive, indefensible, it had to go. Now, in the early 1850s in Germany, a group of anarchist thinkers, including Max Stirner and also Julius Falke, Ludwig Bull and Eduard Mayen, contributed to a newspaper which was called the Abendpost. And I don't know if that's how it's pronounced in German, but that's what I'm going to call it. And they initiated the slogan in this newspaper, abolition of the state. Now, for Marx and Engels, this slogan was an example of their absurd idealism. Now, some people have drawn the conclusion from this, and you can understand them drawing this conclusion on a superficial basis, that if Marx and Engels opposed so vigorously the slogan, abolish the state, that somehow they were state worshippers. They were in favour of this strong, Germanic, centralised state that many anarchists have accused them of. Now, we've got to look at this. In 1850, Engels drafted a reply to the so-called Friends of Anarchy, who I've referred to. Unfortunately, it wasn't published in the journal that he intended it to be published in, and it wasn't, in fact, published until 1927 in a Russian journal. And in this, he considered the slogan, abolition of the state. And he says, for communists, abolition of the state makes sense only as the necessary result of the abolition of classes, with whose disappearance the need for the organized power of one class for the purpose of holding down the other class will automatically disappear. Now, in other words, Engels saw the state as an inherent feature of class society. To seek to abolish the state within the context of a society where real power was in the hands of a minority, an elite, would be to idealistically seek a society where economic monopoly was in the hands of a very small minority, and at the same time there would be political equality. This clearly would be a naive hope. Now, in a letter written in 1872 to a comrade of his in Milan, Engels makes the position very clear. And I quote from it. State power is nothing more than the organization which the ruling classes have provided for themselves in order to protect their social privileges. But Bakunin maintains that it is the state which has created capital, that the capitalist has his capital only by grace of the state. As, therefore, the state is the chief evil, it is above all the state which must be done away with, and then capitalism will go to blazes of itself. We, on the contrary, say, do away with capital, the concentration of all the means of production in the hands of a few, and the state will fall of itself. Now, there are two points which arise from this statement of Engels. Firstly, that Engels, and Marx as well, saw the state as a product of class society. The anarchists, from the evidence of their writings, simply saw the state as an abstract injustice. It needed to be crushed, on that we would agree with them. It needed to be got rid of. They didn't want these coercive forces, but it was an injustice. They did not see the root of it. And it seems to me that while the Marxist critique of the state contained an indication of how to abolish it, in other words, by ending class society, the anarchist critique provides no logical strategic pointers at all. It simply leaves the state there as an injustice. And the second point that arises from this letter, which I just quoted, is that, and there were a number of other letters of this kind from Marx, I've quoted two things to you from Engels, I can refer you to others, is that they quite clearly disprove the assertion that Marx was somehow in favour of retaining a state machine. Both Marx and Engels saw the abolition of classes as the prerequisite for the inauguration of a stateless society. Now, there are many Leninists who might, of course, shudder at this sort of a claim, but the evidence is abundant in the works of Marx and Engels that they were in favour of a society without classes and without government. Now you may ask, how is it that such a society is going to be created? How did Marxists see it? How did the anarchists see it? A society we're talking about with no classes, with no state machine at all, no governments, no armies, no means of coercion. And I may well add, just so that any Leninists who may be present will really be shocked, that all of the evidence of Marx's writing show that he was talking about a society where there would be no monetary system, no wages system, a society of free access to all wealth. How the hell do you create this? Well, it's interesting to think that when you actually look at what Marx saw, a socialist society, a society of common ownership and democratic control of the factories and the mines and the farms, the average Leninist, if they actually got around to reading Marx, which of course very few of them ever do, would read it and say, this man's a raving anarchist, throw away his works, and they'd be burning his books. As it is, of course, they have them up in pride of place in the Kremlin library. Now, in direct opposition to Lenin, Marx argued that working class emancipation must be the conscious political activity of the workers themselves. In other words, there can be no socialism without conscious socialists. It's a hard fact, but there is no other way. You either have fully conscious socialists, and then those socialists in a majority taking political action in order to displace the power in society of the small minority of people who monopolize industry and agriculture and the means of producing and distributing all the wealth and taking it into the common property. Now, it must be said that the anarchists have always regarded this kind of political revolutionary strategy as being quite unacceptable. And there are several reasons for this. Firstly, there is the view expressed by Stirner in particular that any organized movement involves the subordination of the individual ego to the collective cause. For Max Stirner, for example, the liberation of the ego from social domination is the highest form of rebellion possible. In fact, if you read this, it's one of those books, Stirner's Ego and His Own, where you read the first chapter and you think it's a novel, and you read the second chapter and you start wondering, and by the time, just about the time you're getting to the end of the book, you realise that you've been taken for a ride, and on any terms, the thing's a lot of bloody nonsense by any standards. Now, Stirner's opposition to any kind of organised movement to change society is very pleasant and very libertarian, but what sort of rebellion is this going to create? Well, let us assume that Max Stirner, or one of his modern supporters, is addressing a group of starving peasants, or a group of homeless workers, or inmates in a prison. And let us assume that he says to them, look, you've got to keep your egos free from contamination by any movement or any organized political grouping, because that wouldn't be a good thing. And let us assume that they seek this individual egotistical liberation all on their own. Well, of course, the advice which Stirner had given them would be absolutely indistinguishable from the kind of advice that any member of the Conservative Party would give them. It would be, try to solve your problems as an individual. Forget about unity and doing something as a movement. Just try to change things on your own. Now, similarly, Proudhon, who believed that only moral renewal at the level of the individual could improve society, and that trade unions and strikes should be opposed. Proudhon held the view that strikes were barbarous and coercive and that workers should have nothing to do with them. All this is very well, but what are workers supposed to do? Now, the second anarchist argument against Marxism as a revolutionary strategy was based on the claim that it would lead to a tyranny of a vanguard over the community. For example, Bakunin, in his Statism and Anarchy, in quite an accurate prediction of what actually happened in state capitalist Russia after 1917, stated, and I quote, "The so-called people's state will be nothing but the despotic guidance of the mass of the people by a new and numerically very small aristocracy of genuine or sham scientists. Since the people are not learned or scientific, they will be freed from the cares of government and entirely regimented into a common herd, a fine liberation." Now, of course, the crucial phrase in Bakunin's prediction is the one, "since the people are not learned," because indeed Bakunin would be quite right if Marx, like Lenin, advocated a revolution enacted by a learned minority on behalf of the politically ignorant majority. But as Marx specifically repudiated such a political tactic, and as Bakunin's secret alliance within the First International advocated such a tactic, it would seem that Bakunin's criticism of Marx ought more accurately to have been made by Marx against Bakunin. It simply doesn't stand up. In fact, Marx's answer to Bakunin's criticism, some years ago, they discovered, Marx constantly discovering more and more notebooks and translations of works by Marx. Marx, who studied Bakunin's book, Statism and Anarchy, read that book in order to learn Russian. And he started copying notes out of that book in Russian into his own notebooks. And he accompanied it by a number of works in notes in German. And one of the notes, which are on that particular quotation which I read to you, I think is very relevant, because he says, "What does it mean, the proletariat raised to the position of the ruling class? It means that the proletariat, instead of struggling in isolation against the economically privileged classes, has acquired sufficient strength and organization to employ general means of coercion in the struggle against them. But it can only use the kind of means which destroy its own character as a class. Thus, its domination ends with its complete victory, since its class character has disappeared." Now, what Marx is saying here is that the working class can only win the class war by dissolving itself as a class. The working class can only win the struggle against exploitation by seeking to be a working class, which by definition is an exploited class. Similarly, of course, the Socialist Party can only succeed in its political objective by removing the need for a Socialist Party. And the third and final anarchist argument against the Marxist strategy of workers organising for their own emancipation politically and consciously is the very reverse of the last one which I mentioned. Because just as Bakunin attacked Marxism because it was a recipe for anti-democracy, so there were other anarchists who regarded democracy itself as a form of tyranny. According to the people who hold this view, the will of the majority is a threat to the freedom of the minority. Now, of course, this is quite true if you look at it logically. If the majority has its own way and the minority disagree, then the minority's freedom to do other than the majority decision is under threat. It's denied. So the will, for example, of a majority of people in this room to open the window may well be an affront to one single person sitting in the room who decides that they do not want to open the window. Of course, you have to make a decision. The only way you can reverse that way of dealing with things is either by having a fight and the person who is the strongest decides what happens to the window, or you say that the minority must always have their own way and you simply allow the person who is in a minority to decide what to do with the window. Democracy allows the will of the majority to take place. The will of a majority of impoverished people to have enough to eat or decent homes to live in or decent work to do is a threat to the freedom of the capitalist minority who decide that they will only allow commodities to be sold, they will only allow wealth to be consumed when it is profitable to them. Well, of course, the capitalist class is very philosophically sympathetic to this anarchist concern for the freedom of the minority, because historically speaking, they are a minority. They're destined to become a smaller and smaller minority. But for the majority class in society, such undemocratic scruples are simply a political obstruction. Well, I hope to have demonstrated three points in this talk. First of all, that the Marxist analysis of capitalism is based upon an historical perspective which the anarchists have simply lacked. Their failure to understand the system has left them in a hopeless position in relation to changing it. As Marx wrote to Annenkov in a letter in 1846, and this letter was a very lengthy one dealing with the ideas of Proudhon. It's probably the best Marxist statement on the ideas of Proudhon. He says, "A man who has not understood the present state of society may be expected to understand still less the movement which is tending to overthrow it." Secondly, I hope to have shown that Marx understood the nature of the state and advocated a stateless society. The anarchists have spent a lot of time throwing stones at the state while leaving out of the question the system which it exists to defend. And thirdly, I hope to have shown that Marx's democratic revolutionary strategy, which was rejected by the anarchists, even though they have had no serious political alternative to put in its place, that the alternative to the idea that the working class as a class must consciously, politically, democratically take action to run society on the basis of common ownership and democratic control, that simply has not, there's been no alternative. Now, after all that, Comrade Chairman, there are still those people who will say that Marxists and anarchists are, after all, after the same goal. And in conclusion, I want to dispute that claim by posing a very simple question to you. I won't give you the answer, I'll leave it to you. If there is a football match in which one side know what they are playing, they know that they're playing football, while the other side does not, in which one side plays as a team while the other side is more interested in the freedom of the individual and each group person in the football match kicks a ball in their own direction according to their own rules so that they have the freedom of the ego, in which one side kicks the ball while the other side stands around arguing with the referee because they think he shouldn't be there, how many of you would conclude that there are both sides in the football match who are heading for the same goal? Of course they're not.